It's Friday, and as usual, there's plenty of news to catch up on, and that's why it's time for the Weekly News Roundup. Welcome. Thanks for being a part of the full story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak, and as we do most Fridays, we're going to take a look at some of the major stories that have been in the news over the last week or so. Now, later on in the show, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about Farmington-headquartered UTC. They're proposing to merge with Raytheon and move the corporate headquarters to the Boston region. The Lamont administration says not to worry. It's just a business decision that doesn't reflect poorly on Connecticut. Some Republicans and business leaders say that's just not accurate, and it reflects poorly on Connecticut. We're going to talk about that. Abon Gudama is going to be joining us, and we're going to get a Boston-based business reporter. But we're going to start today by finding out what's going on in New York and Albany. The Assembly is getting close to the end of the session, so there's a lot going on right now. And to give us some guidance, we're calling on WSHU's Karen DeWitt. And in a few minutes, we're going to be joined by Michael Gormley, the Albany reporter from Newsday, and David Lombardo, the Capitol reporter with the Albany Times-Union. But first, just Karen. Hi, Karen.
Hey, Ron. Yeah, it's been very busy here this week.
Have you gotten any sleep? Has anyone gotten any sleep in Albany?
Well, you know, I have to say we have, because unusual for Capitol tradition, things are not happening in the middle of the night. They're actually passing bills during the day, which is just something that doesn't happen here. For instance, right now, they're passing the renewal and strengthening of all the rent control laws. They had a victory rally this morning, and they are voting right now on them as we speak. The rules run out at midnight tonight, and normally in past years, they'd be passing them around 11:30 in the evening. But they're going to be done probably by mid-afternoon, and they're going to get them in one day early.
So give us a rundown. Let's start with the rent control laws. To be honest, I was going to start with the religious exemptions for vaccinations, which was passed and signed. But and I heard you talking about it during the newscast. But
yeah,
let's start with the rent control laws. If you could run down what's happening with that, and then we'll go back to the vaccinations. What are they trying to do now?
It's the strongest tenants' rights measures. Really, in over a generation, it's ending what's known as vacancy decontrol, which resulted in over 300,000 rent-stabilized apartments going to the free market at a higher rate in the last couple of decades. It allows upstate and parts of Long Island and the Hudson Valley that don't already have rent control to opt into rent regulations if a municipality's leaders decide they want to. It also extends tenant protection statewide, that it's going to make it harder for landlords to evict tenants. And it also makes permanent the rent laws. For years and years, as long as I've covered things here, the rent laws would expire every 3-4 years, and that would give a lot of incentive for the real estate industry to give a lot of big campaign contributions to politicians, hoping that the laws wouldn't be strengthened, and a lot of opportunities for tenants groups to organize and come up here and shout and chant and fill the halls saying that they want them strengthened. So that's taking this kind of cyclical nature of the rent laws really out of the equation here by making them permanent.
I was reading the other day that some real estate moguls are said to be devastated by this.
They're pretty shocked. In the past, they had the Republican-led state Senate on their side. Now it's led by Democrats. I think they also seem to think that Governor Andrew Cuomo was going to stick up for them more. But Cuomo took himself completely out of the rent negotiations, which is also unusual for the Capitol.
And I think they were surprised by that, again, by the reports, because in the past they have been active contributors to the party.
Yeah, but they didn't give that much money to the Senate Democrats, who are now in power, or the Assembly Democrats. So they just didn't have influence. Plus, you know, I just think it's not a year for landlords with all the different political things that are going on in this country, in this state. A lot of Democrats are worried that they might get primaried from candidates who are even more to the left of them. So they really can't do things to help landlords at this point. So it just really wasn't their year. And, you know, either Governor Cuomo miscalculated by staying out of the rent regulations because now he can't take as much credit for them being approved, or maybe he just felt like he just needed to be out of it for repercussions later.
And as you were pointing out, this doesn't just affect New York City, because when you think of rent control down here, most of the time you think about New York City. But as you pointed out, the suburbs are affected.
Yeah, though the majority of it has been New York City, but this really could change the game if municipalities in the suburbs want to opt into it, or the vast areas of upstate that don't have rent-regulated apartments. I mean, there's certain rules. It has to be six or more units. They have to be built during a certain time period. I think it's about 40 years ago, up to 1974. So there are restrictions, but it does kind of change something that was always a New York City issue, and now, you know, upstate, Long Island, they're also having issues with, you know, finding enough affordable housing for people. And tenants groups, anyway, are hoping that this will help. Certainly, we heard debate on the Assembly and Senate floor today from Republicans saying they think the opposite is going to happen, and that landlords are going to be so restricted that, you know, they might abandon their apartments, they won't make needed improvements, and they won't invest in affordable housing. So that's the prediction from the Republicans. They're not going to win this fight today, but they're certainly on the floor right now making that point.
And I want to point out that we are talking about this in the early afternoon. The reason I point that out is because our program is played back between 7 and 8, and by then, the vote may already have happened, huh?
That's right. But unlike what happened yesterday with the vaccination legislation, this is pretty certain that this is going to be approved by both houses, and maybe by 7 or 8 tonight, that Governor Cuomo might have already signed the regulations into law.
Okay, you just mentioned the ending the religious exemptions for vaccinations, which from my perspective, seemed to happen a lot faster than I thought it was going to happen. Could you walk us through it?
Yeah, well, originally it was just going to go through the health committee in the assembly, but then they decided, because pressures were so high, you had the so-called anti-vaxxers here very upset, yelling and screaming. They thought they better, while they could hold it together, just go to the floor of the assembly and pass the bill. It just barely squeaked through the committee meeting. Some of the Democratic members voted yes on it and then voted no on the floor, including, kind of stunningly, as you heard in my report earlier this hour, the Assembly Health Committee Chair Richard Gottfried. He voted against it, saying he doesn't believe that the state should mess with people's religious freedom, and he thinks that more public health education would be the answer. So the final vote, as I mentioned, was 77 to 53. It's a 150-member House, so they only had one more vote than they needed to actually pass the bill, and it was a pretty chaotic day as the debate went on. And, you know, there was a point where I thought, I wonder if this is even going to pass. It seemed in doubt. And certainly at the Health Committee meeting, they didn't have enough votes at one point and had to convince one member to get up and say, yes, I'm voting for this just for the good of, you know, all the rest of the Democrats who want it out on the floor, but I don't support it. And that was Nader Syed, who is a Westchester Yonkers Democrat.
What were those in attendance saying? Why were they so angry at the legislation?
Well, you know, they just really don't seem to accept a lot of the scientific evidence that vaccinations are a good thing. They are afraid of them. They don't want their children to have them. They believe that it could cause autism or, you know, other diseases and harm their children, even though the medical evidence says that doesn't happen. And they're very, very passionate about it. And, you know, it's interesting, Ron, it's not just one political persuasion. It's people kind of on the far left and the far right, evangelical Christians, you know, kind of leftist, maybe extreme progressives, you might call them, who are really, you know, worried about this. And we saw, you know, both of those people represented in the rallies yesterday, where at one point after the vote in the assembly, they essentially shut the assembly down. They were yelling, they were shouting, they were using vulgarities, they were making threats against the assembly sponsor, Jeffrey Dinowitz, for standing up on the bill and convincing others to vote for it. So I can't really think of a time where the assembly's really just been shut down because of protesters shouting from the galleries.
And Karen, we had a program that we did on vaccinations a few weeks ago, and I have to tell you that some of the emails and responses that we got were, as you say, very passionate from on both sides.
Yeah, you know, I think think it's just a sign of our politics right now that everything is intensified and people are just more passionate, more emotional. I've noticed that in Albany in the halls, more, you know, groups are coming up in bigger numbers on a number of issues, not just rent or the vaccination issue, but many issues, and people are just very motivated. And you know, certainly this week, things have really gotten very heated.
And so as soon as it was passed, the governor signed it right away?
Yes, he did. Within a few minutes of it, he signed it very quickly. He had initially expressed some reservations about, you know, messing around with religious freedom. But in the end, he said, you know, the public health risk outweighs that, and we need to do this.
We have a number of issues that we need to get to in the next segment. I think we're going to be talking about where the legalization of marijuana stands, giving undocumented immigrants the ability to obtain driver's licenses, and also the prevailing wage legislation. So we got a lot to talk about coming up, right?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Looking forward to that.
Stay right there, Karen. Michael Gormley is also on the line with us, Albany reporter for Newsday, and David Lombardo, the Capitol reporter with the Albany Times-Union. Hi, Michael. Hi, David.
Great to be here. Thanks a lot.
How are you guys? Just want to get some quick thoughts from you before we move on to another topic. Karen and I were just talking about the rent control legislation and also the end for the religious exemptions for vaccinations. Michael, since you represent Newsday, in terms of the rent control laws, any thoughts about that and its effect on the suburbs, specifically Long Island?
Potentially, it's a significant effect, and not just on the suburbs, but some of those upstate cities. Rochester, in particular, has a narrow vacancy rate, and that's how this would kick in. It's a vacancy rate. That means the number of apartments that are available for renters is under 5%. Then this rent control or this rent law could apply, and it gives a lot of protections for tenants. Now, if communities in Long Island and elsewhere, the suburbs and these other cities, want to opt into this, it could have a significant effect on providing more affordable housing for people in these areas, particularly at a time when we're starting to see homelessness increasing, and we see it you know, drastically in New York City.
Mm. David, in terms of the religious exemptions for vaccinations ending, Karen and I were just discussing about the passion that was shown by those opposed to ending the exemptions. What did you see from your perspective?
I saw people in the assembly gallery after the legislation was passed yelling things that I can't repeat on public radio, as well as calling out specific legislators by name, including some in the Rockland County area who voted in favor of this measure. In committee, when this was moving, there were people who were crying, visibly upset as the bill was starting to move. I think, like you say, a passionate, very emotional day in the Capitol.
Were you surprised by the passion? Have you seen anything like this before?
I have not seen anything like this in terms of an issue that people didn't want passed. You know, you've seen things like same-sex marriage in 2011, where people were visibly moved by the passage of it, but you haven't seen things where people are distraught by what the legislature is actually doing. In terms of expecting something like this, having seen this crowd in Albany for the last few weeks and months, I would have expected something like this, yes.
Now, I know the governor has signed it into law. Does that mean it takes effect instantly, right away?
Great question.
There'll be a rulemaking process that always goes. Laws in Albany rarely start the moment that they're passed or the moment they become law.
So it's going to it sounds like it's going to take a few weeks?
Usually longer than that. I'd have to check the law and how many weeks we're talking about, but it could take a while until that goes into place.
And one thing I would add,
though,
one thing that affects
ordinary...
is whether... Go ahead,
Karen,
David.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead, David. David, you first and then Karen.
All right, sorry.
I was just going to say, you know, there's a difference between an ordinary rulemaking process for a state agency and when there's an emergency situation, which doesn't require the same sort of public comment period. So they could theoretically, and like Mike says, you probably need a further review of the text, But I got to believe that this was passed because of a so-called public emergency. So you have to believe DOH is going to be in a rush to get regs through and likely won't have to go through the same public comment period because of the emergency nature, in quotes.
Huh. Karen?
Yeah, and I would just add that this one effect this has is whether children who are unvaccinated can attend school or daycare. We're getting to the end of the school year now. My guess is that it would affect the new school year, have the rules in place so that if children aren't vaccinated, it's going to affect them, because that's one of the penalties. They're not going to force them to get vaccinated, but they can't attend school or go to daycare.
Okay, Karen, where does the push to legalize recreational marijuana stand? It did not make it in Connecticut. How does it look in New York?
Well, that's a good question. That was one issue that it seemed like it was not going to happen. And now I think it's gotten some new legs. The Assembly Democrats and Senate Democrats have been talking about it for the last couple of days in their closed-door party conferences. They have a new bill that incorporates a number of concerns that Governor Cuomo had when this was talked about during the budget. So, I think that there's, at least a 50-50 chance that they could act on something next week. That's, one of the, three or four big issues that are remaining that they're going to go through with the final week of session starting Monday.
Michael, I remembered, it must have been a month or two ago that the governor basically said this is going to happen. And I thought at that point, okay, he's going to throw all his political weight behind this. What do you think? Is it going to happen?
I don't think anyone knows for sure. Karen's absolutely right. There is a renewed push here. I would caution that some of that is that no one wants to stand up there and say this bill is dead, because it's very popular. It was popular in a poll that just came out this past week. I think there is a new energy, but there's some serious opposition, and it's not just people who are opposed to recreational use of marijuana. It's you still got some very powerful lobbies in law enforcement. Several of the health groups also still have some serious concerns. So it's a much tougher bill than it seemed to be last fall in the elections, when this was a very popular issue.
David, if it does go through, will counties be able to opt out?
Yeah, that's the language that was first sort of put into the governor's bill, and what we've seen in other states as well, giving municipalities that authority to opt out. And I think that's part of the problem, is that we've seen counties preemptively say they're going to opt out, which kind of removes an incentive for lawmakers, especially on Long Island and potentially in Hudson Valley, to vote for this. If your county not only is going to not participate, not benefit from the revenue, what's your rationale for voting for it? There's obviously not that clamor in your community.
Karen, you and I had talked about the polling on this in the past, and I know that poll that came out from Siena College basically said the younger people are mostly for it, but those over 55, the speed limit, are against it by, I think, around 54%.
Yeah, that's true. And who goes out to vote more, the older people or the younger people? Probably the older people at this point. But the majority does support it. So it does seem in a way that it could be a safe vote. And I think they really only need a few more Democrats to get it over. But especially in the Senate, they could pass it with 32 votes, but they want to have maybe three or four more votes so nobody is accused of being the 32nd vote. A lot of this comes back to Long Island and the so-called marginal Democrats there that the Senate Democrats don't want to lose, and they don't want to put them in an awkward position or give Republicans an issue to run against them in 2020. And this could be one of the issues that Republicans could use if something goes wrong in the process of legalizing marijuana.
Mike?
Ron?
Yes. I'm sorry, David. Go ahead.
I was going to say that this is one of those issues where it's really hard as a standalone vote, and why I think people thought this could get done in the budget, because it's, tucked in with all these different priorities. We haven't really seen a lot of clamoring for what we call a big ugly here, an omnibus legislation. But if something like that were to emerge in the final days and the governor was on board with the marijuana text, giving a message of necessity, allowing them to kind of rush this through, then maybe that could help this along, too, if it's tied to other things.
Michael, one of the bills, and I'm not sure where it is right now, I think it's still being debated, is to give undocumented immigrants the ability to obtain driver's licenses. Where does that stand?
Well, that's another tough one, and it does come down to, as was mentioned, to the Long Island Democratic senators. This is a bill that almost everyone who studies it comes away, even who were opposed to it before, comes away from it supportive, or at least understanding why it would be a better thing for road safety as well as security, public security. But the problem is, this is a bill that would allow driver's license to be issued to people that are undocumented, that would be, some would call, just undocumented immigrants. The first time you say that rings sour in a lot of people's ears. It's always been opposed by people who hear the soundbite. They're trying to legislate this by getting people to understand that there's some real benefits here, and that the claims about it fostering terrorism are just unfounded. But it's tough to legislate when you have to go that deep into the argument, and that's what they're trying to do. Right now, again, law enforcement is very concerned, although they've had some of their specific concerns addressed. But you know, it's tough for moderate lawmakers to go back to their constituents who fear that this is just going to open up a new tool for terrorists.
And Karen, I know that some county clerks have already been quoted as saying, if this passes, I'm still not going to do it because these are illegal immigrants.
Yeah, they really can't get over that. I mean, I think some of the opposition is the concept is you're going to reward these undocumented immigrants for doing something that was illegal, coming into the country illegally, and some people just can't get over it. You mentioned polls a little while ago, Ron, and the Siena poll showed that upstate particularly people are opposed to this, and you know, there are also all pockets of resistance to this. So that's kind of the idea, but as Mike said, if you get more deeply into it, you realize that a lot of the undocumented immigrants have jobs, and they're driving without licenses anyway. So it would make places safer. States that have had this have found that there's a less incident of hit-and-run accidents because an undocumented immigrant has a license and isn't tempted to run away if they get in an accident. So there are good reasons on both sides. But, yeah, again, it's kind of stuck in the Senate right now, and that's going to be the big question next week. Do they do this bill now? I mean, there's an argument to do it now because it's the spring of 2019. Elections don't happen for a year and a half for the Senate and Assembly until November of 2020. Will people forget about it by then? I mean, we live in a very fast-paced news cycle world. Or is this, again, something that Republicans could use against these Senate Democrats who, you know, sometimes won their elections by very small margins?
David, I'm unsure of where the wind farm off the shores of Long Island is currently in the state process. I keep hearing that there's going to be a press conference any day now to let us know what's going on, but we're waiting. But in the meantime, is there any climate change legislation that may come up in the next week or so?
Yeah, that's another one that's kind of on life support as far as I view the issue. The Assembly, which has passed the bill multiple times in the past, is on board with doing it again. The Senate, not as clear, despite the fact that they claim to have majority support and majority are on the bill. They've talked about last-minute amendments. The governor has said, you know, this issue's dead, says, you know, he's almost dismissed this bill, you know, talking about political placebo effects. And only recently, after getting backlash, has said more positive things about how it's still on his agenda. But I kind of don't see them pushing something like that through in the last 3 days of the session in the Senate.
Michael, can you break it down for us a little bit? What's in that legislation?
Well, what we've got is continuing to have caps on carbon emissions and basically going after the sources of global warming, the gases, and I guess I would throw out one thing, although I hesitate to ever disagree with your other reporter there, but
please do, Mike.
The governor did just sort of breathe a little bit of air into this whole thing. As almost a throwaway line the other day, he said that they were still talking about it, which is kind of a surprise because it did seem like it was dead. In fact, he as much as said so a couple months ago. So what we try to do here in Albany is when we're trying to figure out what can go and what can't go, is we try to figure out what the headline is going to look like at the end of the agreements. This would be a nice thing to have in their headline. So I think that it's probably still on. The odds are probably still against it because it's so complex, but I think that there's more of a chance than we thought, a month ago.
Well, I would just add that the legislature essentially wants to have zero use of fossil fuels by, is it 2050 or 2040? And what Governor Cuomo was saying is, that's unrealistic. You're just not going to be able to do it that fast. And I think he got a lot of backlash on this. And, he did let it slip the other day. Well, maybe we're talking about this. So, we'll have to see about that one.
I had seen the date of 2050 and talking. We did a show recently about what's going on around here. And I said, even by 2050, that's a pretty ambitious plan. And some of the experts said it can be done, but boy, it would transform everything. Final thoughts on this one. I hear that Governor Cuomo would like to run again, Karen. For a while, I heard that he wanted to be president, but now there's talk that he wants to stay as governor. What are you hearing in the political process?
Well, a lot of other people said that maybe Governor Andrew Cuomo wanted to run for president. And in fairness, he never did say it himself, though a number of times he acted like he might have wanted to be a candidate. But he has admitted recently that he would like to seek a fourth term as governor. Nobody has done that in the modern era of governing except Nelson Rockefeller back in the 60s to the early 70s. And Governor Cuomo's father, the late Mario Cuomo, governed for three terms and lost his fourth term. So if Andrew Cuomo ran for a fourth term and maybe won, he'd maybe get one up on his father.
I'm not going to go there right now. Michael, your thoughts, please.
Well, I'm expecting him to run for a fifth term. the one thing I would throw out there is that the governor has been a strong supporter of Joe Biden. And the way he describes Joe Biden each time is a guy who has a record, who has a record of accomplishment, a guy who has been able to work on bread and butter issues that Democrats need to win. And every time he gets done talking about Joe Biden, he says, which is exactly what we've done here in New York. So he's pushing Joe Biden, but if Joe Biden at some point falls off the list of competitors, I suppose there might be a spot there for Andrew Cuomo.
Interesting. And David, your thoughts?
I think the governor loves his fiefdom in Albany, and he'll do whatever he can to preserve that. I think he's not leaving D.C. unless he's not going to D.C. except for to visit, I guess.
David Lombardo is the Capital Reporter with the Albany Times-Union, Michael Gormley, Albany Reporter for Newsday, and of course WSHU's Karen DeWitt. I thank all of you, as always, for coming on. Please come back again in the future.
Thank you.
Articles and talk shows have been done for years about Connecticut's business climate. Many business leaders contend Connecticut has been facing its own version of economic climate change, and more must be done to ensure a healthy economic future. So, when an announcement comes from someone like United Technologies Corporation, we all take notice. Well, UTC had an announcement a short time back that made all of us pay attention. WSHU's Ebongo Dama is here with the details, and we're also going to get perspective from Larry Edelman, the deputy managing editor and content coordinator for the Boston Globe. He's joining us via Skype. And columnist Larry Edelman, it's a pleasure to meet you and have you on the program. Thank you.
Thanks, Ron.
Ebong, I'm going to start with you. What did UTC say?
I spoke with Governor Lamont a couple of days after the announcement, and he said he had been in conversation with UTC's CEO, Greg Hayes, and that Hayes had assured him that, the UTC would still have quite an investment in Connecticut, even though they're moving their headquarters to Boston after the merger goes through. And here's the way Lamont framed what's going to happen. This is me talking with Lamont earlier this week.
100 people from headquarters are moving to Boston. Pratt & Whitney will be hiring 1,000 new people. Otis will be staying in the state of Connecticut and expanding.
What about Carrier?
I think Carrier is already spending most of their time in Florida, so I'm not as sure there. But the good news is that Connecticut continues to be a leader in advanced manufacturing, jet engines, helicopters, submarines, and UTC, the band formerly known as UTC, now Raytheon Technologies, is going to double up in terms of their commitment to the state of Connecticut in terms of manufacturing.
And basically, what he's saying there is that they're going to have a thousand new jobs at Pratt and Whitney. They're going to expand the presence of Otis even after they've spun off Otis, because they're going to get rid of Otis and Carrier. So that's basically the way Lamont is looking at it. And he seems to feel that we can still retain businesses in Connecticut if we do certain things. And I asked him about that, and this is what he said to me.
I think we have great medical, we have good education, and our transportation is slipping. That's why I really think that if I make New Haven and Hartford, you know, transportation hubs, is important. That's part of what we want to do to upgrade our transportation system. Look at what we could do with New Haven. You could double the size of New Haven if it was a major transportation hub with Tweed Airport next door, train service coming from New London, coming from Hartford, and coming up from Stamford. That's the future of a city like New Haven. We do, to your point, need some up-and-coming vibrant cities. That's how you attract young professionals, millennials.
Well, that's what Lamont had to say about this and the fallout and basically how he's going to deal with it going forward.
We're going to bring in Larry now. As I mentioned before, Larry Edelman is the Deputy Managing Editor and Content Coordinator for the Boston Globe. Larry, thanks for hanging on. Is this a done deal?
No, by no means is it a done deal. It's got a decent chance of going through, but there are several things that have to happen before they can wrap it up.
And how long do you think it would be if everything, all the cards fall the right way? How long would it be before it gets wrapped up?
The companies are saying that they want to complete this deal by March of next year, but that it'll also happen after the spinoffs of Otis Elevator and Carrier.
Did you get anything, any hints that this might be in the works?
No, they kept this under wraps very tightly. It was a surprise to everybody I talked to once it was announced, and it wasn't until Saturday, just, a day before the deal was announced, that the Journal got wind of it, the Wall Street Journal. It was pretty well kept secret.
Hmm. And Larry, how are shareholders reacting to this news?
Well, both stocks are down since the deal was announced. I did a piece a couple of days ago for the Globe that looked at some of those reasons. There's some skepticism here that 1 + 1 = 3, and that's the basic argument that Raytheon and United Technologies are making, is that together they will be a stronger, more profitable, faster-growing company than they are separately.
Larry, I'm so glad that you're on today, because I've spoken with some Connecticut residents, and they're starting to feel a little strange about Massachusetts and Boston, because it seems that so many of the students, the young people, and businesses are heading in your direction. What is it about Boston nowadays that seems to be so attractive from your perspective?
Well, I mean, part of it is the jobs. The jobs are here. The schools are here. It's a good city to live in. It's not as big and sprawling and pressure packed as New York. I've lived in New York, so you can breathe a little better here. It's a little less expensive than New York. It's a lot less expensive than San Francisco, and there are cool things to do. All the things that have made Massachusetts attractive for a long time. But I would, you were talking about this earlier on, I would not see this as necessarily as a ding against Connecticut and its business climate like GE was. I think this is a different situation than GE.
How so?
Well, I think GE really wanted to get out of Connecticut. And I think that they were looking to move. And when Jeff Immelt saw Boston and thought about it, you know, he just kind of fell in love with the idea. Here, I really do think that United Technologies, which is going through a massive restructuring, as you know, needed to make some compromises with Raytheon over where the headquarters would be. Because in essence, UTC is buying Raytheon. So in return for, you know, giving up control, Raytheon had to get some concessions. One of them was the name, Raytheon Technologies. I think the other was the agreement to put the headquarters here. But it's not a ton of jobs. It's 100, maybe 200 jobs at most. So, you know, I really wouldn't read too much into this deal as any kind of commentary on Connecticut as a place to do business.
Abog, I guess it depends on which side of the political aisle you're on, because I know the Republicans, members of the Republican Party, have I won't say jumped all over this, but they were very upset. I'm going to read to you a quote from Vincent Candelora, who's the state rep from North Brantford, Republican, and he said, "Corporate business owners and headquarters are going to make long-term decisions, so whether they started this decision 6 months ago after the election or a year ago, bottom line is they want to see long-term sustainability for Connecticut, and for the last 10 years, Democrats haven't demonstrated that long-term stability."
Well, they complained that the Family and Medical Leave Act that was passed this year was to blame, and the minimum wage increase, and the entire Democratic agenda pretty much was anti-business, so the $15 minimum wage. And Lamont made the point that almost all of those things, Massachusetts already has a Family and Medical Leave Act, and it already has legalized recreational use of marijuana. Mm-hmm. So, and the taxes aren't any the taxes aren't any lower in Massachusetts, and they have tolls on their highways. So all the arguments that are being made by the Democrats as to why by the Republicans as to why the Democrats' agenda is bad for Connecticut, Massachusetts already has this, and the businesses are still moving to Massachusetts.
Larry, how do you view that?
You know, there are some advantages here in Massachusetts. And I think, you know, one of the things is the attractiveness of big cities. And, you know, Connecticut doesn't have any big cities, I think over 145,000, if I've got that right.
That's about right.
You know, Boston is 700,000, give or take. So it's got more of the advantages of the big city. And I mean, when it comes to employment, you can't underestimate the access to Harvard, to MIT, and the rest of the schools up here. And then, you know, the entertainment, the sports, everything. It's quite a package.
Well, you know, what's happening in Connecticut is that because we cannot compete with the type of attraction that a Boston would have, Lamont seems to be thinking that having a transportation corridor between New York and New Haven might help, and he seems to be emphasizing New Haven New Haven, and I think the reason why he's doing that is because of Yale, and because it is an educational hub. And maybe that will be the basis for trying to develop that area. He mentioned Tweed New Haven Airport. Now, Tweed New Haven, I don't see how it's in such a narrow strip of land. I don't see how they're going to be able to expand that.
It's in a
neighborhood. It's in a residential neighborhood.
Right.
So I don't know, but
and it's flood prone, and with all the storms coming through nowadays and global warming, the water is coming up. And some have said Tweed Airport needs a lot of work over the next decade just to survive in its current state.
So I was surprised that he threw that in when he was talking about what to do in New Haven to try and attract business.
Larry, I'm very interested in your thoughts on this, because you were the senior editor at the Wall Street Journal. You lived in New York. Now you're living in Boston. And when you hear about obviously, Connecticut, when you hear about these plans to revitalize the cities, starting with New Haven, probably Stamford, Bridgeport, and so on, not to mention Hartford, will that stop corporations from moving to a place like Boston? Do you think that can be done?
I think it can be done. You don't see it can be done. Look, Providence, I think, is in a similar situation, and it's got the advantage. It's only 45, 50 minutes from Boston by train, and they're out there scraping for businesses, and they're having some success. In some ways, what you can do is position yourself as a lower-cost alternative either to New York or to Boston. Because let's face it, it's expensive to be in Boston. Office space is expensive. Employees want higher salaries. So I don't think it's it can be done. And up here in Massachusetts, Worcester is going through a big revitalization, mm-hmm. Lowell. So it's not like a slam dunk that eventually everybody is in Boston or everybody's in New York. I think there's room for companies to find, depending on what businesses they're in and what kind of employees they have and their size, I think there's room for other cities as well and other locations.
Right away I'm thinking about San Francisco and how I remember San Francisco when San Francisco was San Francisco and you could actually afford to live there. Sooner or later it's going to happen that people are going to say, I can't afford this. I need to look elsewhere. I need to look at a Worcester. I need to look at a Lowell or a New Haven or something like that.
Absolutely. And look, this week, we had a derailment on the subway line, the Red Line, which is a major subway line in Boston, the biggest. And it's created a nightmare because it took out some track and then it took out some signaling, and it's been a very slow process getting, they're still not back to full service. And it's created not only a mess on the subway, but on the highway as well, coming up from the South Shore. So Boston is starting to really see the negative side of all this growth. It's getting crowded, it's hard to commute, and housing prices are high. So yes, the value proposition, if cities position themselves correctly, I think they can play that.
And it seems as if what we have here in Connecticut, Lamont seems to be very, very focused on transportation. As a matter of fact, he's calling the legislative leaders in on Wednesday to have a meeting to try and figure out when they're going to have this special session on transportation. And also, he seems to also be pushing 5G. He's really big on that, and that he feels that if we can improve our internet speeds, that will greatly help in attracting businesses here.
Well, when you read about 5G, supposedly it will transform the way we live. So if everything they're saying is true, then if we don't do it, if Connecticut doesn't do it, if Long Island doesn't do it, we're going to be one step behind everybody else. Larry, from everything that you're hearing and from what we've been talking about, is this as big as a story as some make it out to be? And the reason I ask that is next Tuesday and Wednesday, we're going to be on this program doing a number of shows about the business climate in Connecticut. And I know this will come up. And some will point to this as saying Connecticut is in trouble because corporations are leaving. And with it, taking their part of their workforce, but also the managers will be moving out. And the guys at the top who make a lot of money. Are we making too much of this?
I think so. One of the reasons I jumped on this story is because, Boston, when I first came to the Globe, there were a lot of big companies headquartered in Boston. And over the years, one by one, they've been acquired, and we've lost those headquarters. But look at where Boston is now. It's a much more vibrant city economically than it was in, 1990 or 2000. Or even 2010. Headquarters themselves, I think, in my view, it's an antiquated notion. Hmm. It's not a place where you've got, companies are moving away from these places where you have lots and lots of workers all in one place. Now, there are some exceptions like Amazon, which wants to put a ton of workers down in Virginia, but Amazon is not your typical company. And if you look at GE, the headquarters there, even if everything had gone right and the company hadn't fallen apart, they were talking about 400 headquarters jobs and another 400, digital programming jobs. That's not a huge amount in the grand scheme of things. And with Raytheon and United Technologies, it's even smaller. You're talking a couple hundred jobs, You know, UTC and Raytheon, and UTC could hire that many in a week, depending on what else it's doing, you know, at Carrier or at Otis. So I think all in all, there are a lot of interesting things about this deal, especially from shareholder perspective and from Defense Department perspective. But I think what this means about the Connecticut business environment is maybe a tad overblown.
And Ebong, with the 30 seconds that we have left, final thoughts, please.
Well, I think that this is not going to make that much of a difference. I think that what's going to happen here is that it's going to make Lamont have to work a little bit harder to try and convince people that the sky is not falling. And maybe that's a good thing in the long run.
WSHU's Ebong Udama, Larry Edelman, columnist, Boston Globe. Larry, thank you. We appreciate your time.
Sure thing.
Larry joined us by Skype. I appreciate it, Larry. That's going to do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan, our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.